Thank you, Robert. Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. See, Robert just turned the timer on. I think that's to protect you. Listen, I'm thrilled to be here, and I so appreciate being invited. As Robert said, I've been in this area in Atlanta a number of times, and so it's a real treat to be invited back. And I'm really intrigued and a big fan of what is being done with the Atlanta Roundup events, and sort of going to different areas around the city and around the area to sort of having kind of a traveling road show, if you will, and I think that's a neat deal. And you guys have had some great friends of mine that have been a part of this over the last few months, and my good friend Masoon is coming next month, and but this month you got me, so we'll make do with what we've got. And you know, this is it's always a reflective kind of year, time of year for me. My sobriety date is June the 30th of 1989, so I'm coming up on 28 years between drinks, and I certainly didn't anticipate going this long between drinks. I didn't stop drinking on purpose on June the 29th. It's the last time I've had a drink or a drug. And I always say I don't know whether that's the last time I will, but I can certainly mark on the calendar, I can quantify my physical sobriety. And my sponsor would always say that's a measurement of time. It is quantifiable between my last drink and tonight. But it doesn't in any way measure my spiritual condition on any given day. And that kind of ebbs and flows. You know, it's sort of like the stock market. You can, you know, sometimes we crash. And but I like to think that on the whole, I'm a stock that's trending up over that 28 years. And but it's also reflective because, as most of you know, this is tomorrow will mark the 82nd anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, but for that anniversary, I wouldn't be coming upon my anniversary, and nor would any of you that are here. At least things might have looked a little different. And I'm struck, and it's not lost on me. There used to be a great speaker in AA named Norm Alpe, and Norm would talk about, but for seconds and inches, how his life would have been different. And I would say that but for seconds and inches, Alcoholics Anonymous hung by a thread by so many moments that if one little thing had been different, it would have changed the chain of events that ultimately ends up having all of us here tonight. So I think that there was perhaps a divine intervention in part of all of that. But here we are, and I'm thrilled to be a part of it. As I said, my sobriety date's June 30th of 1989. My home group, I'm going to say for the first time ever, my home group is the Recovery on the Road group of Alcoholics Anonymous. After over 18 years of the backroom group in Nashville being my home group, and it's still dear to my heart, a friend of mine and I started a new meeting in Nashville on Wednesdays. And one of the reasons for that is I'm gone an awful lot of weekends. And I wasn't a very good home group member. The group was serving me very well, but I wasn't serving the group very well. So I will still be, if you come to Nashville on a weekend, I'll still be at the backroom group. If I'm in town, my attendance won't change. My level of participation won't change. But I'm now more likely to be at home on Wednesdays, and I've got a group where I can be counted on to be there much more of the time. And I'm excited about that, and we're having a good time. When I took that drink on June the 29th of 1989, I'm embarrassed to tell you that that last drink I had was an Amaretto on the rocks. Yeah, I'm ashamed of that, and that's just not the way I would have gone down if I'd have known that was my last drink. You know what I mean? There'd been a little meeting. They said, "Steve, here's the deal, pal. You can have one more drink. What will it be?" Amaretto would not have made my top 10, especially if I thought that I would be regularly sharing that story with people like you. I would have had a much more exciting ending. I would have crashed and burned, and I would have risen like a phoenix from the flame to this new life today. But I just kind of weenied out with a little amaretto. wife and I have, I was scheduled into treatment on July the 1st of 1989, and scheduled is exactly what was happening. At this time of year, I was kind of preparing. I had been convicted a year before of my 6 DUI. I was living there in Nashville, where I live now, and I was in Brentwood, a little bedroom community south of Nashville, and I came out of a restaurant slash bar one evening. I don't know if you've ever gone into a restaurant around 6:30 that turned into a bar around 9:30. And when I came out around 11 or 12, I went the wrong way down the street, and I hit a Brentwood police officer. And apparently that's an arrestable offense in Brentwood. And I came to in the Williamson County Jail the next morning. Truth is, I was dressed much like I am tonight. My tie was still firmly knotted up against my collar, and I think an alcoholic will take his props where he can get them. I was clearly the best-dressed man in the drunk tank that morning. And I called my wife to get me out. It's not the first time I'd called my wife from jail, but it's the first time she encouraged me to call somebody else. And I called around. I finally got a guy came bailed me out. And around 1 o'clock that afternoon, I was in a lawyer's office. And I had called. I was actually being tried for a DUI in Davidson County, Nashville. And my Davidson County lawyer was kind of tired of me and pointed me toward a Williamson County lawyer for this offense. And so I was in Franklin, Tennessee, the hub of Williamson County, and sitting in a lawyer's office. And he asked me a question I don't remember being asked before. And what I'm going to tell you tonight is I'm going to do my very best to be honest with you tonight. But I'm often honestly mistaken, even about what happened to me. I sometimes suffer from a past that never actually happened. And because what our book says that what we do, I'm encouraged to do a couple of things tonight. One is to share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And for years I thought that's what I did. But it became clear that's really not quite what I do. Really what I do is share with you what I think I was like. I share with you the experience of what I was like, what it felt like to be me. How I viewed the world, how I saw things. But I'm seeing things through the prism of my alcoholism. I'm seeing things in a skewed way. And what I realized is, as I talked to other people that were present, I got a wife that was present, I had a mom that was present, a brother that was also my employer that was present. We will talk about things, and they were having a different experience. They would describe things differently. I know I don't always see things as they are. I'd given a talk one night. My wife was with me. We went back to our hotel room that evening, and she said, "Steve, you know that last 15 minutes of your talk?" I said, "Yeah, babe." She said, "I would love to meet that guy." And I wish you would bring him home with you some night. And so what I realized, literally and figuratively, is how I see me is not always how other people see me. And just as true as how I see you is never the whole picture. So I'm going through life making life-altering, life-changing decisions based on bad information that's filtered through a defective character. The only way I can have defects of character, I guess, is if my character's defective. So what happens is I'm shackled by this bondage of self that shows up looking like those seven deadly sins and all their cousins. So I'm shackled with pride. I'm shackled with envy and jealousy and sloth. Sloth is, you know, lazy, man. That's a big, I'd like to have some other problems, but the truth is lazy is a big problem for me. And usually I say, well, that fourth step, that's just, I don't want to feel that pain. No, Steve, just write something down, man. You're just too lazy to do it. I'm shackled by that bondage of self, but I don't know that. I don't know that's the root of my problem. But I'll tell you what the experience was. The people in my life weren't asking me to stop drinking. And that lawyer that day, he said, "Steve, do you think you've got a problem with alcohol?" And that's the first time I remember being asked that. I knew that I had alcohol-related problems. That's a little different. You know what I mean? I could connect the dots between, you know, to get a DUI, you got to be drunk. I thought. Until I was sitting in a meeting one night, there was a new guy in there. It was a beginner's meeting, and I could tell this guy did not want to be there. And I could tell he was kind of had a dour look on his face, you know, and I introduced myself. I said, "How you doing, man?" And he said, you know, he just kind of muttered something. And I said, "What brings you here?" He said, "I got a DUI for having a broken tail light." I said, I don't believe you, but I know what you mean. You know what I mean? I said, I think you got pulled over because you had a broken tail light. I think you got a DUI because you were drunk. But I understand that thinking. In my home group, my old home group, we called that alcologic. But that lawyer asked me, he said, "Steve, you think you got a problem with alcohol?" And I said, "You know what, pal? What I think I got's a legal problem. I wish you would focus all your time and attention on this legal dilemma I have and save that sermon for another day." And he said, "Okay." I mean, he backed up and he said, "Okay, let's go to work." And he did this legal thing, you know. And about 3 months later, 4 months later, we came out. This was in March of 1988, sometime in the summer. I don't recall exactly now when we finally went through this deal. There was a plea bargain agreement. They were trying to put me in jail for a year. I'd had multiple DUIs. Again, I had totaled 6 automobiles. Most of my DUIs, I didn't have to be chased down. You know, they just arrived at the scene of the accident. And there I was. And my worst one was right here in Atlanta in 1980. I had been at the TGI Fridays at Roswell and Sandy Springs and throwing back kamikaze shooters and taking Tylenols. Somehow I left there and I got on I-285 going east in the westbound lane, and I hit a car head on and 2 other cars hit us. It totaled all 4 cars. Sent some people to the hospital. It sent me to jail. I came to in the Cobb County Jail the next morning with just a fuzzy memory of what happened. I'd urinated on myself and I'd thrown up on myself, or I hope I did, because somebody did. If you've been in the drunk tank, and I know some of you have, goal number one is to stay upright and find a wall to be against, right? But I was unsuccessful. But I prefer to think that those stains were self-inflicted. But I will tell you in all honesty and sincerity that I found myself there that morning. See, I hope we have a good time tonight. And our book says that cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. But I also know that and want you to know, in case there be any question, none of this was funny while it was happening. But what happens is, with some time and distance, I begin to be able to look back at my life through the prism of today's recovery. And I can see the absurdity of life as I was living it. I can see just how crazy some of this stuff was. I can see how dangerous it was. I don't want you to think that I think a head-on collision going the wrong way down the interstate's fun. You don't get a gathering of alcoholics and or Al-Anons or family members of this size that somebody's life hasn't been inalterably changed by a drunk driver. So I know that. And I know that where there have been those fatalities and people, that nothing separates me from the people who have done that other than God's grace or dumb luck on that particular night and other times. So I understand that. Don't think that I mean to make light of that. But I get to stand here today and look back at my life and see the absurdity of it when our book says that that while I will recognize that my alcoholic life, I won't be able to differentiate the true from the false. And my alcoholic life will seem the only normal one, even though I know it's injurious. I know I drink and get in trouble. I know I drink and hurt the people I love the most. I know I drink and don't show up. I know I drink and humiliate myself. But I'm going to do better. I'm always going to try harder and do better. And that alcoholic life seems the only normal one when I'm going through it. And I get here today and I look back and I go, how could that have ever looked normal? How could it have ever seemed normal? But it did. I just thought, I'm just navigating through life and it's just happening to me. The other thing I want to say is, if you're kind of new tonight and you're listening, sometimes as I listen to speakers early on, it sounded to me like they knew what was going on while it was happening. And I can tell you, everything I share with you about my alcoholism and about my recovery is looking back at it through today's vision. And when it was happening, man, life was just, my friend Bob says, life is fired at point blank range. And that's what it felt like. Man, I'm just constantly under a barrage and responding to life, reacting to life, not with any kind of plan, not with any strategy. It's just happening and boom. But that guy's asking me about this. We do the plea bargain agreement, and ultimately they were talking about putting me in jail for a year because they were using words like chronic and habitual, and I had not been a very, you know, nice guy when they arrested me that night. I'm not a very tough guy. That's going to be clear. I mean, if Amaretta didn't make that clear, and I'm not a very street smart guy. You know, I was scared to death about the prospect of going to jail. I don't have the skill sets for jail. And but that night, apparently, I tried to bribe the police officer, and that's not such a bad thing. But I tried to do it with a check. And, so just a tip: if that's going to have any chance at being successful, it needs to be a cash transaction. And a check creates a paper trail that they'll use at court. So I wouldn't do that. They do the plea bargaining agreement. Ultimately, they land. They're going to give me 60 days in jail. And I literally said to my lawyer, he came down and he's telling me, and he is pretty pleased with this legal coup that he has pulled off. And he said, "Steve, good news. You just have to do 60 days in jail." Well, as you might imagine, I'm waiting for the good news. And I literally said, and it's almost embarrassing today, I said, "Man, I don't think I'm a 60-day guy." And as absurd as that sounds, couldn't really understand how. I mean, I literally thought that I don't do 60 days in jail. I mean, I know people that do jail time. They're jail people, you know. I've seen them. They should be doing some jail time. I'm not one of them. I'm in the drunk tank thinking I'm different from the other people in the drunk tank. Somehow, and I don't see the absurdity of that. Today I do. Anyway, he goes back and he says, I said, "Would you go talk to him one more time?" And he did. And he came out and he said, "Okay, this is as good as it's going to get." He said, "You can either do the 60 days or you can do 10 weekends and go to residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation," which sounded like a mouthful, and it didn't sound much better than jail. But that's what I, you know, benevolently said I would do, as if I had multiple choices here. And so I had a year of probation to complete both the jail time and the treatment. And I'm coming up on the end of that year, and I finally have to go to treatment. I searched out treatment facilities. I'd collected. It looked like I was visiting college campuses, man. I got everything but a Pell Grant on this deal. And I ended up going to a place called the Harbors of Brentwood, not a mile from where I'd hit that police officer. And today it's an assisted living facility. My buddy Ricky came by on the... My wife and I went out with three other couples on June the 29th. We had kind of a last hurrah, went to dinner. It wasn't a particularly wild and raucous drunk like many had been, but this was what we were going to do, and before I headed off for a month, we went with three other couples. Came home after dinner, and I smoked a joint and had an Amaretta and went to bed. Yeah, just another Thursday night at the Lee household. Next day, we took my daughter Abby, was 5 years old at the time, and I'm going to spend time with my daughter Abby before I'm going away on a 28-day business trip. And we went. Some of you have heard that. We took Abby to Chuck E. Cheese, and I know the story just gets darker and darker. But while I'm not a tough guy, just sort of a public service announcement, if you're not sober yet, don't spend your first day sober at Chuck E. Cheese. It's loud in there, and they're coming at you from every angle. And about how, you know, been there just as I'm gaining my emotional balance, I saw a 6-foot mouse. And I said to Connie, "Baby, do you see the mouse?" And, Saturday morning, July the 1st, my friend Ricky came by to pick me up, and Connie walked out. He's taking me over to treatment, and Connie walked out with me, and her last words to me where no matter what, baby, don't stop drinking. And my wife and I had been married 7 years at that point. We had met 8 years before. We'd met in a bar over a pile of cocaine. That was her cocaine. She was just back from Lake Tahoe. I said she was a catch because she was freshly divorced with a pocket full of divorce money, a divorce pickup truck, and an eight ball of cocaine, and it was on. And really, my buddy Ricky, who was taking me to treatment, he had been set up on a blind date with her on the night that I met her. But she and I were attracted to each other for all the wrong reasons. And Connie, lest I forget to say so, her sobriety date is 10 days after mine. And she's an active, effective, wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she sponsors women, and she does 2 book studies a week in our home. And with the women she sponsors, that's how she sponsors. And I wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be married to each other if that hadn't happened for us. And she arrived at her decision not knowing what I was going to do while I was gone. It's a different story that she can tell. But it was almost 4 years before she came to Alcoholics Anonymous. She white-knuckled her sobriety for 4 years, and she's got that story to share. But that morning, she says, no matter what, baby, don't stop drinking. Just go do your time and come back. And look, we had trouble in our marriage, you know. She wasn't trying to get me to stop drinking, though, but she would wish I would drink with her more often. She would wish that I wouldn't drink with some of the people I was drinking with as often. She'd wish that I could be a better husband and be a better father. And it's just people just want us to drink in a way that suits their particular needs. And I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to be hurting people, but I get drunk. And when I get drunk, I do stuff. Our book says when the alcoholic drinks, something happens. I've always said that should have an exclamation point at the end of it. It's not just something happens. No, something happens when I drink. It's about to get exciting for somebody. Usually not me. Anyway, Ricky's driving me over there. He says, man, what do you think this deal's going to be like? I said, I don't know, man. I mean, I had so many emotions. I was angry that I had to go. It didn't feel fair. Again, a guy like me doesn't go to treatment. If I don't go to jail, I sure don't go to treatment. I was anxious. I was frightened. I was uncertain what to expect. I had no idea, but I said, I'll tell you one thing, I don't know. But I said, I'm not getting in some little circle and going, I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic. Whining about the most intimate details of my life, you know. And about 3 weeks later, I was just telling people more than they wanted to know about me. And I was making stuff up, too, because I'll be honest with you, Amaretta and Chuck E. Cheese will get you no street cred in the treatment center. And I used to have a much more exciting story than the one you will hear tonight. I mean, it wasn't true, but it was exciting. But what I discovered and what I would encourage of any of you is that the thing of value that I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous is the truth about me. Our book says we tell the new man exactly what happened to us. So for me to shy away from something that did happen would be a disservice. And for me to embellish or make up something would likewise be a disservice. My story is not going to resonate with everyone. My story is not supposed to resonate with everyone. That's why we all tell our stories. Sometimes we do it from the podium. Sometimes we do it in our home group. Sometimes we do it over a cup of coffee. Sometimes we're doing it on the telephone. But ultimately what we do is one alcoholic shares with another the truth about him or herself. And we give that opportunity for identification, not just with the external consequences and circumstances of our drinking, but about that core of alcoholism where we're not unique. When I got to that treatment center, they gave me I felt like a test. I know now what the term is, assessment. And they're going to assess whether or not I'm alcoholic and or drug addict, and if so, apparently at what level. And there were 30 questions. There were other questions on this, but there were 30 questions that all began with the phrase, have you ever? That's right. That's overly strident right out of the gate. They explained, have you ever means even once, and even with a really good reason. Have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking? 30 have you ever questions, which, as you know, just have check yes or check no to what I contend are clearly essay questions. These are questions that beg for an explanation. Now, again, we laugh, but that morning, I will tell you, I could not make myself check the box. Part of the reason is because I think I know what they're asking. Again, and that's been part of my problem all my life. I think I know. You know, have you ever drank in the morning? I mean, I got questions about the questions. What do you mean morning? And I think it's a reasonable question because I'm thinking I know what they're asking. I think they're asking me if I'm that guy that's got to wake up at, you know, 4 in the morning and reach over and grab that half pint off the nightstand, take a pull off of it just to be able to get to the bathroom, to fight it down enough just to be able to get my day started. And I've done that a few times, but not so often I'm checking it on this test. But what if I'm out at a very nice establishment at 2 a.m. at last call somewhere? Is that morning drinking? And if I just check yes, you're going to think I'm like that guy. Have you ever drank alone? Yeah, but they left. I mean, that's just, where'd everybody go? We were just here. It was a party just a minute ago. But again, I think I know what they're asking, right? I think they're asking if I'm that guy that's got to go home and lock the door and pull the shades, and it used to be unplug the phone, but now just put it on silent or turn it off and hide from the world and drink in isolation. And certainly I've done that a few times, but not so often I'm checking it on this test. But there's another kind of alone drinking that a guy like I did. Maybe you. I'm a guy that had to drink to go drinking. I got a few drinks at home. I got to do whatever I'm doing at home so I show up ready to play. You can't show up cold. There are expectations of me when I get there. Our book calls alcohol, amongst other things, a social lubricant. And man, I get that. It's like oiling up. And when I'm greasing me up, and then I can move easily amongst you. Without that, I feel self-conscious. That self-centeredness that is at the root of my problem. I don't understand that. I don't have the language to call it that. But I've got this hyper self-consciousness that makes me uncomfortable and makes me feel like the ball in the pinball machine rather than the guy that's moving easily about you. Now, what I would tell you is I don't think anybody in my life would have described me as being uncomfortable. I think people would have described me as outgoing. People would have described me as gregarious. People would have described me as funny. I was a pretty popular guy. I was a social guy. I mean, I had a social sphere. And I had to work really hard to not let you see how I felt. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting to act like I got my stuff together when I don't feel like it's together. And I know what it's like to stand in front of a door and steel myself up to get ready to walk into a work situation or a family situation or a social situation. And then what it's like to leave and go on the outside of that door and finally be able to take a real breath. But to get in that car and go home and feel empty. Lonely. That's not the word I would have used the first 3.5 years of my sobriety, but my wife and I were about to get divorced. Sober. And we were seeing a marriage counselor and this therapist. About the third time that I saw her individually, I was prattling on about something, and she just stopped me. And she said, "Steve, you must really be lonely." And man, it cut me to my core because that's not the word I would have used a minute before she said it. But the moment she said it, I knew it was true. And she said, "That old country boy bullshit isn't going to play in here." She says, because she says, "I bet you're a pretty popular guy." And she says, "I bet you go get 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there and 5 minutes there, and then you're empty on the inside." So that loneliness, the source of that loneliness, I've discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the lack of connection, the lack of authenticity. What Chuck Chamberlain described as our problem that entails all problems is conscious separation from man and God. I'm not really, nothing's really getting through. So I am going through life. You know, one of Bill's writings in the 12 and 12, he talks about we're like actors in a play who've forgotten our lines. Boy, that resonated. That's what the world felt like to me. I'm an actor in this play, and I don't know my lines. I'm improvising. I'm trying to figure it out while we go. And it seems like everybody else knows their plays. And I'm trying not to get caught improvising. I'm trying not to get caught not knowing. Because I got this hyper self-consciousness, this self-centered fear, this selfishness and self-centeredness that is at the root of my problem. It is the root from which everything else seems to spring and grow. And it looks like different things at different times. But at its core, stone sober, this inward malady manifests itself in this hyper self-consciousness. You know, our book says that we alcoholics are sensitive people. That's not a compliment. I know it's not, because right after it, it refers to it as a crippling handicap. I'm sensitive. I can walk in this room. Sometimes it can happen today. This is not all old stuff. Stuff shows up. That ebb and flow that I talked about. On the day when things aren't aligned, when I'm not trusting the God of my understanding, when I'm feeling disconnected, and you make a little sideways glance at me, I build a backstory to that look. I got a whole series of things that brought that on, and pretty soon I got to hate you. It's just important for you to be wrong. Because if it's not you, it's me. I took that test, and here's what I would tell you, lest I forget. First of all, I didn't do well on it. Another one was, have you ever had a blackout? And I'll be the first to say that you don't have to have blackouts to be alcoholic, and maybe having a blackout doesn't make you one. I don't know, but I'm a blackout drinker. And I love what the comedian Dave Attell says. He said that he's a blackout drinker, as he likes to call it, time travel. and I get that, you know, where you just go, whoa, how did I get here in the future, and what has been going on? And some of you may have done like me. You don't ask direct questions. You kind of read people's faces the next day, right? I wonder how it went. Was I just kind of cute, or did this thing go way off in the weeds, you know? And you just kind of worry. And then you got a buddy. You know, we've all got the buddy that you call and said, okay, man, well, you know, tell me about last night. And you go, oh, Steve, man, even you don't want to know about last night, brother. So I come about 3 weeks into that treatment stay. I'm hearing people. We're going out to a multitude of 12-step programs, but AA primarily. And people are bringing meetings in. And I'm attracted to the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous right away. It's an interesting bunch. It really is. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be like. I don't know what I thought. I don't know what you thought. But you didn't look or sound like I thought you would. I mean, really, every day in AA is like the Jerry Springer show, and you know, without the paternity test, and sometimes with the paternity test. But it's an interesting group, right? And I'm fascinated, and I decided that I recognize that I need to not drink. I know by now I need to not drink. I don't know what that's going to look like. I'm not sure. And AA is how I'm going to not drink. But I don't yet really know what AA is asking of me. You know, I mean, I'm seeing the steps on the wall. I'm hearing some stuff, but I don't quite get it. If you're new, you might not quite get it. And someone else like me may have decided they need to not drink, which is different than wanting to not drink. And so I decided I'm going to not drink, and AA is how I'm going to not drink. But I thought that AA was going to be an awful lot of not drinking. I thought not drinking was an actual activity in Alcoholics Anonymous. We will get together and not drink. Would you look at him not drink over there, man? You see the technique on that guy? He kind of reached for it and pulled back. And God said, hey, Steve, we're going to go to the Titans-Falcons game Sunday. You want to go? Man, I'd love to go, guys, but I'm busy Sunday. I'll be home not drinking. And that a life in AA was going to be all about where I can't go, what I can't do, and who I can't hang out with. It's going to be a very small life. It's going to be a life of self-sacrifice. It's going to be, and I'm prepared to do it. I'm just going to hold on and not drink. You know, somebody said, don't drink even if your ass falls off. So I'll be home not drinking, guarding my ass. And and I will tell you that has not been my experience. And my guess is for most of you that have been here for a while, that's not your experience. Because this is a tough place to just do time. This is a tough place to not drink. But what you promised me, those of you who were here ahead of me and have had the experience yourself, shared with me that what would happen at a certain point, and our book talks about it around the 10th step, that the drink problem would be removed. It'll be a daily reprieve, but it'll be removed. And it says that this will happen with no thought or action on my part. And I read that and I go, what do you mean, man? I've been working my ass off here in AA. And you say, this happens with no thought or action on my part. But the truth is, what's happening is once I got to AA, you guys redirected my effort. Before I got here, I'm coming at my problem with everything I got. I'm going to do better. I'm not going to stop drinking, but I'm going to drink less and less often. I'm not going to ever let that happen again, whatever that was. I won't do that. I won't hurt her. There's a whole lot of stuff, and I'm coming at it with firm resolve and good intentions and doing the very best I can. And you guys say, Steve, you're ill-equipped for that. That's not going to work. Because not drinking, to the untrained eye, looks like the treatment for alcoholism. But what you guys told me was to redirect my willpower. The 12 and 12 says that lack of willpower is not my problem. It's the misuse of willpower that's my problem. So you say redirect that away from fighting the problem to embracing the solution. The solution in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the other thing our book asked me to do here tonight, says each of us in our own language and from our own point of view talks about how he established a relationship with God. So that's what we, and that's the only solution AA has. There might be other solutions. I'm not in charge of that. I wouldn't tell anybody that this, but if I'm in AA, what AA says is that I'll need to find a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. AA says if I've got alcoholism, as AA describes it, I'm beyond human aid. You guys can prop me up. You guys can support me. In fact, the God in you can help, can connect with the God in me, but ultimately it's going to require something other than human power. And the way I'm encouraged to use my willpower is to go in search of that power. To do those things, to look and face and be rid of those things in myself which block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, where the solution is. So it's not coming at my problem with firm resolve, it's surrendering to the solution. So getting engaged in this program of recovery that you guys opened up for me, this design for living that you encouraged me to embrace. I don't even have to be very good at it because I'm not very good at it. It's not the level of, it's not technique in AA. It's commitment. It's surrender. It's willingness. You know, our book says willingness is the key. I was 18 years sober before I looked up the word willingness. It says, among other things, doing that which I would not do as a matter of course. That makes perfect sense to me. There is nothing AA has asked me to do that I was just about to do before I got it. Nothing AA has, everything AA has asked me to do is counterintuitive, contrary to the character that walked in here. So the way I exert myself, the way I utilize my willpower, is to point myself away and embrace what, and says, follow these simple steps. Pick up this set of spiritual tools. Do a few simple things. And I can do those. And through that process, I get connected with this power. Now, tomorrow, I'm doing a workshop tomorrow if anybody's a glutton for punishment, and a lot of it's going to be talking about the struggle, and today the position I have with that power. But you know, we say in AA that we are these are just suggestions, and I've decided, you know, if I'm a guy that believes what the big book says on one page, and I've got to believe believe what it says on another page. I can't selectively choose, and our book says following are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery, and on page 164 it says. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. Sidebar. Have you met the guy that realized he knew only a little? He's not in my home group, and I'm not him. Okay, but so these following the steps we took, what you're suggesting, so they're just suggestions. But here's the thing: if you're new, it's the only suggestion we got. We don't have a second suggestion in AA. So if you want to do something else, which any of us are fully entitled to do, that's fine. Just AA's probably not the place to do it. There's nothing to argue about here. Our book says that if our man wants to try some other spiritual approach, we encourage him to follow his conscience. Encourage, not discourage. Reminding him that as alcoholics, we have much in common. So I've stumbled over some things, and you might have some of the same problems. But man, if somebody's going to try something other than AA, I hope it works for them, because they're betting their life. Early on, if somebody tried something other than AA, I wished them drunk. So I didn't use my outside voice. It's embarrassing to tell you that I hoped they would get drunk to make me feel better about my choice. Today, I'm totally uninvested in that. What I know is my experience is my experience, and that's the one that's the only one that I have any say over. That's my experience, and we share our experiences with each other. I got out of that treatment center, and I'm going to not drink, right? I'm going to do my best to not drink. And so I went down in Nashville to the Friendship House, the 202 Club, that just celebrated its 54th year in existence there. And I wandered upstairs, and I fell in with some people that just literally changed my life. And they were I walked into there were three meetings that go on at any given time, particularly back then. And I wandered into the smallest little room. There was about 12 or 13 people. And the guy that would become my sponsor, Frank D., was in there. And some other folks. And they were having a big book study. I didn't know there were even different kind of meetings. I didn't, you know, but they're having a big book study. Now, downstairs, in what Frank lovingly called the half measures tables, they were calling them big book thumpers up there. And it wasn't a term of endearment. But I will tell you, that's not the experience. I know a big book thumper, because I've been one. And it's unattractive, at least the way I did it. I wielded that book like a club. You know, at about 6 years sober, I was gifted to see things that clearly the rest of you couldn't see in that book. And I shared with you, unsolicited, my point of view. And I was earnest and I was well intended, but I was self-will run riot, even though I didn't think so, and I'm just slapping this thing around. See, that's not what was happening up in that room. Up in that room, those people were simply going through the book together and looking for this design for living. What do we do next? We've been having some good conversations about these steps. So what do I do? Oh, turn my will and my life over the care of God. But what do I do? What did you do? Tell me what you did. And by the way, they might have slightly different approaches. They might have slightly different experiences. They may view it slightly differently. We can look at a piece of art and all look at the same piece of art but see something differently. We can listen to a piece of music and it's the same music but we might hear something differently. Or we may focus on a particular part that somebody else doesn't focus on. So it's this collective shared experience that doesn't have to be contradictory, but it doesn't all have to sound alike either. And these guys are just going, what do we do? Here's what it says. What do we do? You know, our book says that if you're an alcoholic that wants to get over it, there's an important question. But if you're an alcoholic that wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? And it says that's exactly what this book is about. We will tell you what we have done. If I do any more than tell you what I have done, I have wandered off the reservation. And I have wandered off the reservation, by the way. I have sent people on missions with stuff I've never done to please report back and tell me how that goes. Yeah. Hell, I might even try that. So I fall in there with Frank and these guys, and like I said, I'm loving AA, man. I'm loving it in that I sit in that hour and I could really, I was relaxed during that AA meeting, relaxed in a way people didn't know me. I loved the anonymity of it initially. And I loved the anonymity of people. These people don't have a history with me. And they don't have any expectations of me. I don't know, and I don't know what I thought, but I was able to sit there and just relax for a while. And I'm going to meetings and going home and going to meetings and going home, and I'm kind of digging that, and I'm working with Frank, and he's kind of getting me in that book. But I was 6 months sober before I became aware of something. So this would have made it, well, I wasn't six, I was 4 months sober. This would have made it just after Thanksgiving. And after the Saturday meeting at 11:30, somebody stood up after the meeting and said, "We're all going to lunch. Who wants to go?" I'm sure they'd said that before at the Saturday meeting, but that's when I heard, and I desperately wanted to go. I mean, they were going to go down to Shoney's, and I desperately wanted to go. So I got in my car, and I start over there. And I get about halfway there, and I turn off, and I go home. And the next week, same thing. I want to go. I get about halfway there, I turn off, and I go home. I do that 3 or 4 weeks in a row. I don't remember. And the reason is because I was afraid. I was too self-conscious. I was afraid to have an awkward moment. My fear was I would walk into Shoney's and there'd be six people sitting at a table for six. And I wouldn't know whether to pull up a seventh chair. I wouldn't know whether to say, "Scoot over. Can I get in here? Did you mean me?" I was unwilling. I was too self-conscious. I didn't want to be embarrassed. My friend Lyle that lives down here says we'd rather be dead than embarrassed. I said, what I needed was a couple of guys to come over to me after the meeting and go, "Steve, we've been talking, man. We really want you to go to lunch with us. Yeah, we're just arguing over who gets to sit with you." And I would have gone. I would have gone. And by the way, I would have been the head of the table. Because you will have removed the self-conscious barrier. You would have made it easy for me. So what I tell you tonight, if you were here tonight, and somebody says we're all going to grab some ice cream after the meeting, they mean you. We mean you. Come. We want to scoot over and make room. We want you to be one of us. I want to be one of you. I can still fall victim to that. My whole first year or two sober, even when I'm going to meetings, I moved to Richmond, Virginia at a year sober. Now I don't know as many people, right? I pull up to a meeting and there'd be people outside. You know, it looked like a gauntlet to get in, you know, go in. And so I just would sit in my car till everybody went inside because I didn't know how to walk through there and whether to introduce. I just didn't. I couldn't do it. Greeters. Jesus, I hated greeters. They scared me to death. "Hey, you're welcome." Whoa, man. Now, you know, I'm all about the greeters, believe me. I get it, but I got to tell you, that's where I was. Man, I wanted to sneak in. I wanted to audit the class, you know. But pretty soon, you guys made me, you certainly invited me in to make me feel comfortable, but also I understand that going through the process of the steps begins to loosen that bondage of self. See, I was in a meeting one night and I spoke for, I was about 3 or 4 years sober and I talked almost as long as I've talked tonight, you know, and it wasn't a speaker meeting. I got home and I called my sponsor who'd been in the meeting and I said, "Did I sound self-righteous in that meeting tonight?" And he went, "Oh, Steve, you are still asking all the wrong questions, man." He said, "Because the question isn't, did you sound self-righteous? The question is, were you self-righteous?" He said, "But the truth is, you don't care whether you were self-righteous. You're afraid they caught you. You're afraid they're driving around going, 'Man, that Steve's a self-righteous son of a gun.' You're not worried about the defect. You're worried about what the defect looks like on you." And he said, "Here's the news." He said, "Steve, you're not who you think you are. You're not who they think you are, and you are especially not who you think they think you are." And I realize today more than ever how much of my life I spent responding to life based on what I think you think. And since I'm wrong about what you think, I've been aiming at the wrong target all my life. I've been trying to impress you, and it hasn't been impressive. You know, I've been trying to elicit a particular response. I've been trying to guess. When our book says that 12 and 12 says that we have this total inability to form a true partnership with another human being, I think the reason is because I never brought authentically who I was to those relationships. How can I have a true partnership if I'm not bringing the real me to the party? And I didn't know how to do that. I'm trapped. When that third step prayer says that relieve me of the bondage of self, I spent a lot of time thinking that self was in bondage. No, self is the hostage taker. Self is my problem. Self, as Alcoholics Anonymous describes it, is the pride and the ego. Self is that thing that says it's here to protect me. No, Steve, don't go to Shoney's because there might be six people and that will be embarrassing. That's pride and ego showing up, and it says it's here to help. It's like the government. We're here to help. That very thing that I think is protecting me is the very thing that's keeping me blocked off from you. And it says each of our steps is an exercise in ego deflation. It's getting the swelling down on that. So now I begin to be able to connect. Those barriers that are blocking me off from God and blocking me off for you are being minimized. And pretty soon, it's a real connection. There's not a loneliness. When I'm having a conversation with you, it's a real conversation. It's not acting in a play. It's not dialogue, trying to kill time without you catching me feeling uncomfortable. Now, I still, again, all of this ebbs and flows. I mean, I'm here almost 28 years, and I can fall prey to any of this any day. But I'm more comfortable being uncomfortable than I used to be. I see it. I get to be a witness to this, and I go, whoa, would you look at that? There I go again. There that goes. How silly is that? And I try to invite God back into this thing. Because if God's in, then I'm out. Can I find that way a little bit more? I probably should have drank some more in this story. I know you're not going to, if you were looking to identify with the real alcoholic, I might not have accomplished that from a drinking standpoint. I will tell you that when my daughter was born, that 5-year-old that I took to Chuck E. Cheese, when she was born, I was drunk at the hospital and made quite a scene. And she and my wife had to stay at the hospital for about a week. It was a problem delivery, and we were in New Orleans, and I had pulled the mattress. It's kind of like Bill's story. We were living in a little duplex, and I'd pull the mattress into the front room of that duplex, and I couldn't even go to the hospital to visit them. I would go by for about 5 minutes a day, and I was scared to death to be a father, and I was scared to be a husband, and I'm laying there drinking and doing cocaine and smoking dope all day. And then finally would make myself get up and run by the hospital and just do a drive-by and go back home. She came home from that. Connie will remind me that I took her pain medication and would take that. Just a month ago we were talking, and somehow I'd made the statement that at least, you know, I had never gotten a physical with her. And she reminded me that I had. She said, sure. She says, that last couple of years when we would argue, and we argued a lot. We would drink and fight, often yelling. She said, you held me up against the wall with your hand around my throat and your other fist drawn back. That was over 27 years later. I didn't remember that. I don't know the damage that I brought in other people's lives. I know what I remember. I also can't pretend that I know the effect that it has on you. We were, I want to spend the last 5 or 10 minutes here talking about a few other things in sobriety, that change in perspective, the things that happen, the living sober. A lot of life shows up when we live sober. At 10 years sober, we went bankrupt. We lost our home and cars. I remember a flatbed truck came by. They call it surrendering your cars in a bankruptcy, but it felt like a kidnapping to me. They came by and they loaded our cars up on a flatbed truck, and they were driving them off. And I called my sponsor, Frank. I said, Frank, man, they took our cars. He went, no, Steve, they took their cars. To be clear, they took the cars you quit paying for. And well, if you got to be a stickler about it, Frank. But and that seemed like a bad thing, right? But here's what had happened in the interim. For about, you don't go broke overnight. It took a couple of years of things really being tight, of pressure ratcheting up in our home, with Connie and I arguing with each other, with her being mad at me for mistakes I had made, sober mistakes I had made, irresponsibility, not just a mistake, irresponsible mistakes. She's mad at me, I'm mad at her for being mad at me. I had talked to my sponsor, Joe Sullivan, when I lived in Richmond. Joe was my sponsor, and we had talked about when our book says that some of us try to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil till we let go absolutely. And I said, Joe, that implies all my old ideas are bad ideas, you know? I said, I showed up at AA with some good ideas. It doesn't mean everything in my life was a bad deal before I got here. And he said, yes, Steve, that's not what it means. And he said, I'm sure you got some good ideas. He said, we've not heard any of them, but I'm sure you got some. He says, but what you're being encouraged to do is set down all your ideas, because you can't tell the good ones from the bad ones. Set them all down, submit yourself to this process, and the truth will find its way back. But he said, the first idea you need to let go of is the idea that you think you know what just happened. He says, because you're going to want to call it good or bad, right or wrong, fair or unfair, should or shouldn't. He said, the truth is you just know how it feels. But given time and perspective, you may look back on these things and see that it tilted your life in a direction that you couldn't have seen coming. My sponsor today, Don M. from Louisville, says it in by just take the next right stitch, that I can't see the pattern. You got to get up higher to see the pattern. You know, those remarkable designs, alien designs in the cornfield, you can't see those from the cornfield. You got to get higher up to see that pattern. And he says, you don't see the bigger picture. So you got to trust God to take that next right stitch. And when we were going through that bankruptcy, I would have told you that was a bad thing. But we had arguments, and we had a fight one day you can't pretend you didn't have. And I said things you can't pretend you didn't say. And we were just about to split up again. And I said, this is too hard. And I said, if we can't find a way to do this together, then we need to do it separately. And somehow what happened for me was I got in that marriage. I got all in that marriage, in a way that I didn't know that I wasn't all in already. It was a different level of commitment and partnership in that marriage that totally changed that relationship with my wife. Now, I will tell you, so was I going bankrupt or was I undergoing relationship counseling? I don't know. I wouldn't trade having gone through that experience to have the relationship with my wife I have today, but I will likewise tell you that if you came to me today and said, Steve, here's the deal. You're going to have 3 or 4 years where it's going to be really tough. You're going to go broke. You're going to lose your home. You're going to lose your cars. You and Connie are going to argue a lot. But, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road, man, y'all are going to be tight. I said, brother, we will work that out another way. You know, we'll get some counseling or something. So I don't have the courage or the wisdom to volunteer for the things in my life that have taken it in a direction. So when our book says that what God has in store for me is better than anything I have in store for myself, today I begin to believe that. It doesn't mean that the painful and challenging times aren't painful and challenging. It just means that I trust that things are operating in a way to a grander design. And that if I stay committed to this process, you know, when it says you and the new man must walk day by day, hand in hand, in the way of spiritual progress, and you will soon live, you will presently live, in a wonderful world, regardless of your present circumstances. And I believe that means that I can be all right now. I can presently be okay, regardless of my present circumstances, when that trust is in God. I discovered that I spend most of my time before I got to AA and much of my time now getting ready to have a good day. You know, just soon as. I remember in 1997, we got so close and to a good day, but somebody moved. So I'm going to tell two quick stories and I'll be done. And some of you have heard it. I only repeat this story so often because it has meant so much to me, and it's a silly story in a way. It's more really like a Zen story. So strap in if you've been waiting for your moment of Zen. But I went to a conference in Toronto a few years ago. Now it's been 13 years ago. It was a one-day thing, And I was doing most of the talking during the day, and we broke for lunch. And at lunch, I'm sitting at a table with eight people, and they came and they took my order. And I ordered a cheeseburger. And the guy next to me ordered a club sandwich. And went around and took everybody else's order, and a little while later, they brought our food back, and they gave me a cheeseburger. And they gave the guy next to me a cheeseburger. And I noticed that. He starts eating his cheeseburger, and I said, hey, man, I thought you ordered a club sandwich. And listen carefully what he said. He said, I did, but they brought me a cheeseburger. That's it. I said, brother, you don't have to live like that. We can get you a club sandwich. I mean, oh, this powerlessness thing doesn't go that far. We can make this, you know, and I'm waving people over. I'm trying to get their attention and to right this horrible wrong and get this guy a club sandwich. And he said, no, Steve, man, I'm good. And understand, he wasn't just eating the damn dull cheeseburger because that's what life served him. He was perfectly content with the cheeseburger. Now, if he'd wanted to say, you know what I did, I ordered a club sandwich, would you guys mind getting me that? They would have. It wouldn't have been a big deal. It'd taken a little while, and they would have gotten him a club sandwich. But wasn't his life better because he was fine with the cheeseburger? And what I'll tell you is I go through life regularly ordering a club sandwich and getting a cheeseburger, and it ain't okay. I go through life waiting for the world to get my order right, and I've not even placed my order. I go through not knowing that I've made a list of demands on the world, and you, our book says, the 12 and 12 says that we will see that we've been making unreasonable demands upon ourselves, upon our fellows, and upon God. I mean, if you're keeping score, that's everybody. There's nobody left to be unreasonably demanding of. God is letting me down, you are letting me down, and I'm letting me down. So it says this isn't a life, going through this process of recovery, isn't a life of now having my demands met. It's a life of lessening my demands. And that doesn't happen because I get smarter. It doesn't happen because I get more virtuous. It doesn't happen because I become a good guy. It happens to the extent that I am surrendered and go through the process of these steps. And those demands, what I need so much less. I am more and more comfortable under whatever set of circumstances. The last thing I'll say, I promise. By the way, you know the two biggest lies in Alcoholics Anonymous? And they're the most repeated lies in AA, too. You've heard them. You've said them. I'll be brief. And I'll end with this. If you hear either of those, strap in. You got a while to go. But I'll be brief and I'll end with this. I knew that you guys told me that for me to move forward, for me to really get some freedom, for me to not just be free of alcohol, but to get some freedom from that bondage of self, that unmanageability of my life, that inability to manage to be okay under any set of circumstances, that it was going to require this power greater than myself. Once I said I'm alcoholic, you said, well, if so, you're probably suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. I thought, damn, I was hoping for something else. Because I don't know that I believe in a spiritual experience. I don't know that I'm capable of having one. I don't know that I want one. I don't know if I'd recognize it if it showed up. All of that stuff. I wouldn't pray the Lord's Prayer. I'm going to, again, talk about this in detail tomorrow. But ultimately, I'm trying to find a conception of God that will work in my life. And I was 8 years sober before I grabbed hold of the one that I still kind of work with today. And what our book says is that each of us in our own language talks about how we establish the relationship. We don't talk about God that much in AA. It sounds like we do. But what our book suggests we do is we talk about how we establish the relationship. You know, you can ask me about my wife, or you can ask me how I met my wife. Those are two different stories. If you ask me how I met my wife, and I tell you what a great girl she is, you go, that's interesting, but how did y'all meet? And in AA, I'm really here telling you how I met God, not what the relationship is. It says we talk about how we establish the relationship, and these 12 steps are the pathway to the power. And once I get to the power does what the power does. I'm not in charge of that. I don't know how to articulate that. That's bigger than me. But I'm going to spend about 2 hours doing it tomorrow. Because I'll make some stuff up, too. You know. But our book, We Agnostics, simply says that no one can fully define or comprehend that power which is God. So that's comforting to me. No one can fully define it. So we all have a partial experience. But nobody's got the whole deal. It says deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. So that's where God's hanging out. That's what I've decided. God's deep within. Because I'm saying that might be obstructed or obscured. This new relationship might be blocked off by pomp, by worship of other things, and by calamity. Pomp is pride and ego. Worship of other things is anything that I have raised above that relationship with God. If I can make the job, the wife, the kid, the relationship, money, these things become the most important thing. And when they are the most important thing, they are the highest power in my life. And that blocks off the other power, so I'm flying solo. And calamity. Calamity can be financial, it can be sickness and death of a loved one. Or I can get home tomorrow, or the predators could lose 6-0 like they did last night. Now, that seems silly, but I'll tell you what a calamity is, if you've been wondering. A calamity is anything I've decided can't be happening to me. Your calamities hardly ever put me on the precipice of a drink. Oh, I'm empathetic, all right. But I live through your calamity. But you discomfort me a little bit, and I go, this can't be happening. No. No. And then it says, as I draw near to him, he'll draw near to, you know, he'll disclose himself to me. And the way I draw near to him is doing what you guys did for me tonight. You invite me here. You let me share myself with you. You share a little bit of yourself with me. This power shows up in a way I can't define or comprehend. It's made it unnecessary for me to take a drink since June the 29th of 1989. And most of the time has given me a life that's happily and usefully whole. It's summed up in a brief little poem that a mentor of mine named Mo Hollerin in Nashville used to say, and Mo passed away in 2003. But it said, I sought my God, I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three. That's what AA has been for me. We share ourselves with each other. This power shows up. It does what it does. And I'm thrilled about that. Thanks so much for having me.